the headlines. Western countries are conducting evacuations from Afghanistan, are racing against time to meet an August 31st deadline agreed with the Taliban. Israeli forces kill a Palestinian teenager during an attack on a refugee camp near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. And Iranian lawmakers debate the proposed cabinet lineup of President Ebrahim Raisi for the fourth day. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. An operation by U.S.-led foreign forces to pull out of Afghanistan is underway as the withdrawal deadline of August 31st looms. A NATO official says the evacuation is being conducted on a, quote, war footing at Kabul airport. The Taliban have warned the U.S. of consequences if the deadline is not met. The British Defense Minister, Ben Wallace, says Western countries are unlikely to extend the evacuation window. Comment comes as the U.S. military has advised President Joe Biden to decide soon whether to extend the process or not. Advisors have told the White House that the decision must be made by Tuesday to have enough time to pull out around 6,000 American personnel. Biden has already cautioned that American troops might stay beyond the deadline. Meanwhile, the leader of the National Resistance Front of Afghanistan says that the group will not hand over Panjshir province to the Taliban. Ahmad Massoud said that he hopes to resolve the issues through negotiations. But he added if the talks fail, his resistance forces are ready to fight. The Taliban say that they have surrounded Panjshir province and have increased forces there. The group says its members have cut off entrances to the area and are on high alert. Reports, however, say that the public uprising forces have disrupted the Taliban siege. The Taliban have retaken three districts in northern Afghanistan that fell to local militia groups last week. Except for one, all 34 Afghan provinces are currently under Taliban control. A senior member of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned that large-scale conflict with Israel is still on the table for the resistance front. Musa Abu Marzouk said it is natural for any nation suffering under occupation to work for its objectives. The member of Hamas's political bureau said that Gaza is under the Israeli blockade and will try to break it. Abu Marzouk added that Hamas is okay with serious talks, but as far as they do not undermine the rights of the Palestinian nation. Resistance groups in Gaza have engaged in retaliatory rocket strikes against Israel over the past months. They say that is the only way forward to force the regime to end its aggression and lift the years-long blockade on Gaza. Activists from the British protest group Palestine Action have completely halted the activities of one branch of Israeli arms firm Elbit Systems. They occupied the root of the Oldham factory, refusing to come down until Israel stops attacking Palestinians and that the arms company leaves their local town. Our UK correspondent Rob Carter managed to get to the location just hours after the action began to find out what's been happening.
Pro-Palestine activists in England have caused major disruption once again for Israeli arms manufacturer Elbit Systems in Oldham on Monday, after members of the Palestine Action Group occupied one of Elbit's buildings in an attempt to halt the firm's activities. Press TV arrived on location just hours after the stunt was launched.
This isn't the first time that this particular facility has been targeted by Palestine Action, and the group say that they will continue to target sites like this until there is a significant change for the Palestinian issue. Now, they have claimed that they have a long queue of future potential activists lining up to conduct this type of action, and that's because there are many, many people in the general public that feel as if they want to do more for Palestine, and they seem to have reached the conclusion that they have little alternative but to do radical action like what we see taking place behind me in order to force the issue.
As well as occupying the roof, some activists blocked the main road, while others smashed windows before smearing the building in red paint. The colour symbolises the blood of Palestinians killed in Gaza.
These people are saying, here's pots of red paint, we want to stop arms. At some point in time, the arms trade will be as vilified as the slave trade was a couple of hundred years ago, and that's what we intend to achieve through this. Here behind us, many people don't even know it's Elbit because it used to be called Ferranti. It doesn't have a big Elbit sign up. It should have a big sign saying, Elbit, killer of Palestinian children. That's the sign it should have outside.
Due to the illegal nature of these protests, the activists will be arrested. Some already carted off as we arrived. The activists also risk fines, lengthy court battles, and possible jail time. Yet they keep coming back.
No, Elbit is going to close this factory. I give you that as a promise. Elbit's profits are what we want to hit. Elbit as an organisation we want to hit. Elbit will go away because there is enough protest from the communities of this country outside of its factories to say, we do not want your bombs. We want to free Palestine.
Oldham's site is used to manufacture specialist military products, which have been used in successive Israeli attacks on Gaza. So, while Gaza remains besieged, Palestine Action vows to continue, as they put it, occupying the occupiers. Robert Carter, Oldham.
Iran's parliament is debating the proposed cabinet lineup of President Ebrahim Raisi for a fourth day. Lawmakers are reviewing the qualifications of four picks on Raisi's list for ministerial posts. They have so far discussed 11 out of 19 nominees. Supporters and opponents of the candidates are given the stage to speak for or against them. The proposed ministers will also have the chance to present their plans and defend themselves. The four remaining ones will be discussed on Wednesday, when a vote of confidence is set to take place. The Iranian president will have up to 3 months to name a replacement, if any of the proposed ministers fail to win the vote. Raisi has said, the lineup is meant to bring about justice and progress. The Civil Aviation Organization of Iran has rejected media reports that a Ukrainian aircraft has been hijacked and taken to Iran. The organization's spokesman said that the aircraft took off from the airport in the Afghan capital Kabul on Monday. Mohammad Hassan Zeybakhsh added that the plane later refueled at the airport in Iran's northeastern city of Mashhad. It then flew to Ukraine's capital Kiev and landed there on Monday night. The Iranian aviation official said that evidence of the plane landing in Kiev is available and will be published shortly. Ukraine has also said that the information circulated by some media outlets on a hijacked Ukrainian plane is untrue. The foreign ministry said that there are no captured Ukrainian planes in Kabul or elsewhere. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Israeli forces have killed a Palestinian teenager during an attack on a refugee camp in the northern occupied West Bank. Ahmad Hashash was shot dead during clashes between Israeli forces and Palestinians in Balata refugee camp near Nablus. Troops attacked the camp in the early hours of Tuesday. Israeli soldiers frequently carry out overnight raids on Palestinian neighborhoods in the occupied West Bank. The raids often trigger protests by Palestinian residents and result in clashes with regime forces. In one such incident earlier this month, four Palestinian men were fatally shot in the Jenin refugee camp, also in the north of the West Bank. Tensions have run high across the occupied territories in recent months. Palestinians are outraged at Israel's settlement expansion and its crackdown on worshippers of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Correspondent Mona Kandil joins us from occupied Ramallah to tell us about the latest on this particular incident. And Mick Napier, Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, joins us from Edinburgh. Okay, welcome to you both. Mona, over to you. Tell us why Israel actually went into this camp and what happened with this particular teenager.
Well, the Israeli forces raid Palestinian refugee camps, cities, and towns on a daily basis. The Israeli forces claim they destroyed this in order to carry out arrest campaigns and to arrest Palestinians, whom the Israeli forces claim they are engaged in anti-Israel activities, throwing stones at the forces, taking part in demonstrations against the Israeli settlements and separation wall, or even for their activity even on social media. What happened early on Tuesday is that Israeli soldiers raided Balata refugee camp near Nablus, the occupied West Bank, in order to arrest some Palestinians. Then Palestinian youths tried to prevent the Israeli soldiers, the fully armed Israeli soldiers, from storming their homes and to arrest Palestinians. The Israeli soldiers fired at the Palestinian protesters. According to the Israeli military, that Palestinian youths were throwing the stones and blocks from the rooftops of their homes, and that's why they used live ammunition. However, every time Israeli forces face some, let's say, stone throwers, they use excessive force. This led to the killing of 16-year-old Palestinian there in the refugee camp of Balata. The funeral processions would be taking place in the refugee camp of Balata in the afternoon hours.
Rick Napier, when you witness, or not witness, when you hear about such incidents, I was just thinking, Israel has a policy that is reported to be a shoot-and-kill policy when it comes to the people in Gaza, especially. Do you think that Israel can prevent many of these deaths that occur that we continuously keep hearing about, and, of course, all of this happening under the watchful eye of the international community?
No, the killings are Israeli state policy, endorsed and encouraged from the highest levels by the statements of ministers. I mean, my own government has intelligence sources in Israel. They know exactly what's happening. But we also know that when we hear about these killings, it's deliberate, it's policy, and it's deliberate killing of people who pose no harm to the soldiers. It's the tip of the iceberg. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges once reported from Gaza, from Rafah, while it was under Israeli military control. And he said he reported the killings of children that day, and he wrote in an American magazine, he had seen people lined up and murdered in many countries in the world, Guatemala, Algeria during the civil war and so on. He said he had never seen children killed for sport as they were killed by Israeli soldiers in Rafah in Gaza. The testimony of an unimpeachable witness. We know sometimes the Israelis kill British citizens, like Tom Herndahl or the journalist Miller. And we know that when we have the resources of quite wealthy people in Britain, the Israelis lie and say that these people were killed by Palestinians. Then they say it was a terrible accident. And then they admit the truth and they pay damages to the families. Palestinians have no hope when their children are executed, of being able to get any kind of justice. We also know that occasionally, and one example I happen to know personally, where the radio communications from soldiers were recorded and played on Israeli TV, the killing of a young girl called Iman Al-Hams, that it was deliberate, that some soldiers said, look, she's just a frightened schoolgirl, and the officer said, kill her, and then approached her on the ground and made sure she was dead. And we know from these communications that the officer said, kill a child in this area, even if it is 3 years old. The officer in question was vindicated and exonerated by the Israeli army. So we have videos of executions. We have film of a young man put on the ground, stripped almost naked, and then executed with a shot to the head. We know of industrial-scale maimings by snipers in Gaza during the Great March of Return. And so Israel does what Israel does. It kills Palestinians. But you know, there's a big danger, and there's also a big hope. And after the Americans were defeated in Vietnam, they passed massive amounts of aid to Israel to avoid American soldiers, boots on the ground, they called them. And now that they've been crushed in Afghanistan, whatever you think of the Taliban, they defeated the Americans. And the danger is that America will subcontract to Israel its control of the Middle East. But you know, they're also very worried. There's a testimony, I think yesterday, of a Danish member of parliament who went to Palestine and had a meeting with the person who's to become their ambassador to Denmark. And she said they're afraid. They are afraid of people learning more and more about what Israel is doing. And I think Israel knows it's sitting on a volcano. The killing will continue. It will probably accelerate because they think that Biden is occupied elsewhere. But they know they're sitting on a volcano, and world public opinion one day will explode. We've seen this, the previous story you gave of people occupying factories to prevent arms getting to Israel, but also dock workers around the world taking action against Israeli ships. This can only grow. And so I say to the beleaguered and tortured people of Palestine, we will win ultimately.
Okay.
But for the moment, it's agony for the Palestinians. Israel is killing, yes. Israel kills.
Mona, quickly, if you can, when you have an incident that happens in the occupied territories as a whole that involves Palestinian and Israeli security forces, and something happens, let's say a death happens or an injury happens, who can the Palestinians turn to in order to get justice? I mean, do they have anybody they can refer to? How does that work?
Well, Palestinians can't get justice here because we are speaking about Israeli forces, Israeli military occupation forces. Of course, we're not going to the Israeli courts to get Palestinians' rights. That's why the Palestinian Authority and the leadership were trying to reach the International Criminal Court to bring justice for Palestinians, especially speaking about killing children, Defense for Children International have accused the Israeli forces for using deadly force and sometimes carrying out extrajudicial killings among the children. That's why they were trying to bring Israeli soldiers for trial. However, in this case, the Israeli court would bring the Israeli soldiers and claim they are suing them. However, at the end of the day, they would receive only months for killing a Palestinian child or another in cold blood.
Okay, thank you for that. That's a correspondent there. Mona Kandil from Occupied Ramallah. Nick Napier, thank you very much. Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
A simple question.
Is Britain confused over COVID? For 18 months, the public has been given varying instructions about the management of the coronavirus pandemic. Everything from social distancing through to wearing of masks has been the subject of government edict, as ministers relax rules only to reimpose them. This has led to general confusion about what's guidance, what's important, and what's the law.
Many question why they can't travel when they've been fully vaccinated, when this was supposed to be their way out of the restrictions on social interaction and travel. This has turned airports into ghost towns and crippled the travel industry. To make matters worse, explosive messages leaked by the British Prime Minister's former aide, Dominic Cummings, allege that Boris Johnson originally refused to take the country into lockdown because the people dying are essentially all over 80. Meanwhile, the government's track and trace app has forced hundreds of thousands of people a week into self-isolation, a pingdemic that has caused many to simply delete the app rather than find themselves isolated from work, friends and family. This mass isolation has led to labour shortages, cancelled public transport and empty shelves, all due to a lack of staff.
So how does the public feel about the continuing restrictions, even for the fully vaccinated? And to what extent have the actions of individual ministers affected the behaviour of the general public? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. To what extent have the continuous rule changes, for example, about social distancing, affected the level of understanding or the level of confusion amongst the public? That's what we asked the people in London. Here's what they told us.
I think I probably did very vaguely for about 2 days in the March 2020. But to be honest, I don't. And I don't really watch the news much anymore because it's just very, very depressing and it doesn't make a lot of sense. And you've got to that point where it's so frustrating that, to be quite honest, I've given up.
Not massively. As far as I understood it, we were now down to the great British public's common sense.
I thought they were going to keep stuff in. But I think they've changed it now, so there's nothing. And now, but there's still places saying that they want them. So I don't know what I'm doing anymore. So, yeah.
They do change quite a lot. It's difficult to follow them sometimes. But I think most people get the hang of it. People seem to be a bit more polite when you're crossing the street or passing on the path. So.
It's now confused beyond to prepare. I think the mixed messages have been non-ending. They stopped the daily briefings. All the devolved governments are following their own instructions, their own rules, and they have done throughout COVID. So I think it's become very confusing for people. I think most people think it's over, and I think they're behaving accordingly, and they're not really paying attention to anything, certainly anything that central government at Westminster is saying now, because of the inconsistencies, the shambolic nature of the messaging, the double standards, and they don't trust what Boris Johnson or central government is telling them when it comes to this virus. And they know that since the vaccines have been rolled out to 60% of the adult population that were vaccinated, they've left medical science behind and they're now following a course that's driven by ideology, the ideology of the market. So they're carrying out a large-scale experiment with public health, and they've now gone back to their original plan, which is herd immunity.
I think what we've got here is that people are rightly suspicious of Dominic Cummings. But, you know, when thieves fall out, honest men prosper. And what we're seeing here is that two people who were thick as thieves as the beginning of this crisis are falling out. And through their dispute, you know, a lot of facts that we saw throughout the narrative of the pandemic are being confirmed. You know, it was very interesting that, you know, Boris, for example, has said during the pandemic, he was governed by capitalism and greed. And at the start of the pandemic, before we were starting the first wave proper, we had Dominic Cummings, who had been caught on record on the Sunday Times saying essentially the government's strategy was herd immunity, protect the economy, and if a few pensioners died, so be it. And now we've got added to that Cummings himself saying that the Prime Minister was saying, let the bodies pile high.
What does the public think of the restrictions on travel? And does it make sense to force individuals to quarantine, even if they're fully vaccinated, or indeed, if they've fully recovered after having experienced COVID-19?
I think it's, we were reflecting on this in the car when we were travelling up. The fact that we could go abroad last year, unvaccinated, and now, of course, you know, it's great to be in London for a vacation, but it's not where we would have chosen to go. So, I mean, there's a massive irony in that, but I think it's ridiculous. And we're trying to find a way forward so that our daughter can go abroad to study, and it's incredibly complex. I find myself reading and rereading the guidelines on, you know, over and over again, and they do seem to shift all the time.
I do understand that previously there's been probably a few problems with travel that have allowed the things like the Delta variant, so people will be a bit cautious. And I do understand that, and I do understand that in other countries who have had less vaccinations, it's not a great idea to knowingly perhaps transport COVID to those countries or make it worse. So to be quite honest, I don't see anything wrong with us avoiding travelling for a little. I'm a big traveller. I travel to Asia two or three times a year if I can, and I haven't been able to do it, but you just accept that, don't you? For a few years, we've got to be a bit more patient, I think.
Yeah, I'm fine with having limitations on it, because it's not just about us, it's about the countries we could take it to. And just because I'm vaccinated and like you, I've had it, doesn't mean I can't take it somewhere else. So I'm fine with there being some limitations. I actually felt they were quite slow to limit people going backwards and forwards to places like India in the first place.
I understand the travel restrictions. Even if you're fully vaccinated, I still think there should be some travel restrictions, because I think you can still get it, I think, or you can pass it on. But I don't sort of understand the travel restrictions and when something becomes the way you can't go, you can go. So that's basically my understanding of it.
Depends. I don't think we'd like people bringing a different variant in, perhaps, so I can see some sort of strict point there. But, it is a difficult one, definitely. I don't know what's right. Nobody knows what's right. That's the problem, I think.
This is the worst possible government. It's landed on the lap of the British public at the most critical time in the midst of this pandemic, the greatest public health crisis in 100 years, and we have a government of rogues. And it was Edward Admiral who said quite presciently that a nation of sheep will beget a government of wolves. And so this is an indictment of the British public, that they voted in this man, this charlatan Boris Johnson, and this government of opportunists and careerists. They have made a virtue of corruption. They've been handing out huge contracts to their friends in the private sector using COVID as a pretext. They've taken advantage of the shock therapy. Naomi Klein famously wrote that book, which I would encourage all your viewers to read, that these people take advantage of shocks in society in order to push through otherwise rebarbative policies and get away with corruption. And so, you know, criminal negligence is the stamp of this government. And I think when social historians look back on this period in 50 years or so, they will look back with a degree of astonishment that this government was allowed to, first of all, come to power, but to remain in power, regardless of all the missteps over COVID. Boris Johnson's polling ratings are still high relative to his opponent, Keir Starmer. That's an indictment of the British public. It's also a very withering indictment towards Keir Starmer, the current leader of the Labour Party.
I think the answer to that's pretty obvious, isn't it? the question answered itself. We've had numerous examples of hypocrisy, and it hasn't stopped, has it? It's still ongoing.
That's the one thing that I've really hated, because just before all the restrictions finished, I got pinged and I had to self-isolate. And I was wanted to go to work, because I need the money. And then when I saw that Boris Johnson wasn't going to do it, I was livid. And that's what really flipped me from, because I voted Conservative last time, that's what really flipped me. I'm not sure what I'm not voting him next time, though, so.
I don't think anyone would really believe that they are practicing what they preach. It's extremely transparent that they feel that the rules are not for them. One rule for them and another rule for us.
It's a difficult job. I wouldn't want it. some things good, some things bad. I don't like the fact that they're giving perhaps government contracts away in a way they shouldn't do, but I wouldn't like his job. I think he's done fairly well in some respects and not in the others, definitely.
And I think it's been a slippery slope ever since Dominic Cummings and Barnard Castle. And I just think, certainly amongst the people I frequent with, I think there's little or no trust in them being the role models and them modelling what we should do as people. It absolutely feels like one rule for them and one rule for us. Absolutely.
There are different and contradictory things to say here. There's no question that the people are deeply suspicious of the early lifting of restrictions. And if you look around, most people are still wearing masks when I go outside. You know, they haven't simply abandoned them. But I do have to say, if you look at the one thing that was done well in this country, it was the rollout of the vaccine program. We have a lot of vaccine skepticism because of the levels of mistrust of the government. And a lot of people who really should take the vaccine to protect themselves from COVID, which is a serious disease, really is a serious disease. There's no question about that. They've not taken it. And it's those people now who are falling sick. What is true is that children, certainly people under 20, are at very low risk from COVID, even if they get it. And it's principally amongst those groups, the unvaccinated and the young, who are getting COVID now. So we are seeing very large numbers. Certainly independent sages are extremely worried about those numbers and that there may be a new variant, as you say. But actually, the vaccine is effective. The vaccine program has proven to be effective, and we have essentially protected the oldest and most vulnerable. So I'm not, Saeed, an advocate of indefinite extension of lockdowns and curtailment of individual liberties. Of course, that needs to be balanced with a general good. I think a persuasive, inclusive policy of trying to persuade people who are vulnerable to be vaccinated would be the best thing. We have huge numbers of alienated and impoverished people who are refusing to protect themselves because they mistrust the government. I think this is the biggest issue at the center of this question.
Let's look at the facts. By the end of July 2021, according to government statistics, 129,500 COVID-19 deaths had been recorded in the UK, with a total of 5.8 million identified cases of the disease recorded in the same time. Meanwhile, the pandemic continues. In the week up to the 21st of July 2021, 689,313 people had been forced to self-isolate in a single week, causing massive labour shortages nationwide. How does the public feel about WhatsApp messages leaked by Dominic Cummings that appear to show Prime Minister Boris Johnson demonstrating little regard for over 80-year-olds who have died or risk dying from COVID-19?
That's what he says. I don't know whether we can trust him because he done one thing, and they're all the same. They say one thing and do another. So it's, what to believe, I don't know. That's the trouble.
I think we only know about 3% of really what's going on with these leaks. I think there's a Machiavellian enterprise that one day will all unravel. But to be quite honest, I wouldn't be surprised if Boris Johnson is leaking things about himself in a very, very complex way. I think it's a tip of the iceberg, and I think you just have to ignore really what is being said in this. It's a game being played out by a few politicians for their own benefits, not for ours.
I don't know what he believes. I don't know what Cummings believes. But the fact that they're willing to dish the dirt on each other just shows you the kind of characters we're dealing with, doesn't it? I'm not surprised. And even from the joke memes, you know, that they seem to just get the tone spot on. It would seem that there's a private face to what the government says, which is pretty shambolic. And there's the face that amongst themselves. And certainly I feel that they treat us with contempt, really.
I'm not surprised, but then again, I don't really trust what comes out of his mouth either, so I don't trust anything at the moment, so...
They're in a difficult situation. It's difficult to read the nation at present. Working people have absolutely fallen out of love with the Labour Party, and therefore there is no national-scale opposition. And while some people are struggling to build one, I myself have been a part of that. I think George Galloway has been a part of that. The election result at Batley and Spen was very significant. There's not been a left candidate who's come and received 20-25% of the vote in any election for 100 years. So Labour have held this monopoly as the second British political party. They are just being disintegrated. And as a result, people are simply voting for the only party which is there, in their opinion, in most elections, which is the Tory party. So they're almost indemnified against their own failure, you know, by the current political dynamic. It's for the working people to create a force that can change that. At the moment, there's little sign of it. Of course, there was the Aylesbury by-election, in which the Tories were defeated by the Liberal Democrats. There's a deep malaise and a deep discontent, essentially, with worsening standard of living, which has been happening really since the 2009 crash and has only been made more profound and will keep on getting worse over the unfolding years. But until there's a political expression for that that can challenge the Tories electorally, they're kind of sitting back and wondering how they're getting away with it at this point.
I'm not surprised in the slightest. It doesn't come to me as a shock. I don't think it'll come to anyone with any scintilla of political consciousness or who understands what Boris Johnson is and who he is and how he operates and how he thinks. This is an Eton educated fanatic, and he has scant regard for public health. We know that he was resistant to the idea of a second lockdown in the winter. He said, let the bodies pile high. This is coming from Dominic Cummings, who was then his chief advisor. The man's a disgrace. He has a stone in his chest where his heart should be, and he's shown that throughout this pandemic.
Does the public have any idea when the pandemic restrictions will finally be lifted? Or do people fear that these limitations on civil liberties, including vaccine passports and travel restrictions, will be in place forever?
I think it will change, definitely. It's just giving it time. As long as no more variants come in or another strain of something comes in, I think you can't control us forever that way. It's no good for the economy. It won't do any good for anyone, so you can't stay in it forever, definitely not.
Eventually, I think this is going to be around in some form or another, with some kind of restrictions for maybe 4 or 5 years. Who can see beyond that? I'm not a scientist. I really don't know.
I think we'll be living with it for a long time. There does seem to come a point where you have to jump one way or the other, I think. But certainly it seems like we are reaching a form of, almost by accident, a form of herd immunity. But I think certainly the people, I think people wish to still wear the mask and still keep their distance. So I think it'll almost be pushed by the public more than central government. I think that's certainly where it feels. Certainly where I live in Bristol, it's the compliance is still really, really strong. Even though you go into a shop, people say you don't have to wear your mask, but you know, people do.
I hope so. But part of me deep down thinks no, but can but hope.
Not forever, but for a long, long time. I reckon another 3 years at least before it's perhaps to what it was in 2019, 2020. I think we're just, like I said before, we've got to hold our breath and be patient, because it's going to take a long time to work its way out, I think.
I understand the argument, and certainly if you look at a lot of people, independent sage, they will have a similar point of view. I think that we're not going to see hugely increasing rates of vaccination. Now we're getting to the point where GPs are returning vaccine to the vaccine program, because actually the people they're offering it to at this stage are the ones who do not want to have it. So what we've now reached is probably we're getting close to the limits of the people who will voluntarily accept vaccination. The question is whether we're going to coerce them or persuade them. I would advocate persuasion. It seems as if our government are going down the lines of coercion, which will create further problems and compound the inequalities. In terms of the world, this is far from over. Okay, if we look at Indonesia, they've only vaccinated perhaps 5% of their population. The only country throughout this pandemic, or one of the few countries, there are others, who managed it really well, are China, who had an initially very stringent lockdown in the areas affected, targeted response, graded response across their community, used technology, mobilized their resources to deal with it, and through public health measures prior to any vaccination were able to achieve zero COVID. I have total sympathy with the people from independent sage experts who essentially think we should achieve independent COVID. But we have to recognize that within our socio-political system and with a government and an economy that are totally unwilling to, you know, make the changes to achieve that, whilst we can criticise and say we shouldn't have started from here, we are where we are. And actually, the only effective tool we've had is vaccination. Vaccination has worked for us. What we really need to do is vaccinate the rest of the people. Yes, there can be further variants. Actually, we've seen that vaccines are effective against all the variants that we've seen so far. So this is something to monitor, but not something to radically change our perspective, in my opinion. But the other countries, yes, we need urgently to allow them to deal with it. They haven't got social systems that have allowed them to achieve zero COVID. They're getting, you know, massive waves that we've seen in Indonesia, as we've seen in India.
Right.
And, you know, that is a system, that is the system of global inequality that is also inherent to our world today that we're dealing with, rather than a medical problem.
Well, I'm following the medical science. I'm not following Boris Johnson. It was Boris Johnson or his government that was telling me that I had to do these certain things in order to manage COVID. Then I would be asking serious and cynical questions. But I think we have a problem that we have a crisis of media information, and we have a crisis when it comes to the growing traction of conspiracy theory, because we now have some of these conspiracy theory cranks, and they are cranks, they're anti-public health cranks, who are now turning their guns on the NHS. There was a demonstration in London just last weekend where some of the speakers were comparing NHS doctors and nurses to Nazi doctors and nurses that were working in concentration camps in the Second World War. You could not believe it. This is where we are now. This is a debased culture, and the conversation around COVID has been absolutely horrific on the fringes, but it has a growing traction with otherwise intelligent people now believing that this is some sort of encroaching fascism. Wearing a mask is an unacceptable imposition, and social distancing is the start of some kind of lurid conspiracy in order to keep us under control, and some kind of open prison with the World Economic Forum and Bill Gates and you name it. So there have been a lot of casualties of COVID, those who died of the disease, those who've suffered long COVID, but there's also been casualties of those who've suffered a collapse in intelligence and in nationality.
There is increasing anger and frustration about the limits on international travel, with people losing confidence in their ability to understand what they're allowed to do. They fear that if they do book something, they'll end up high and dry abroad or facing quarantine at home. With the additional revelations of messages by Dominic Cummings about his former boss, the Prime Minister, which seemed to suggest Boris Johnson was not very worried about elderly COVID-19 deaths, many question how seriously the government is taking the impact of the disease on the elderly and infirm.
There is a risk that the government will lose the cooperation of the British public through inconsistency, confusion, and the fact that ministers themselves have set a bad example through their own behaviour. For Britain and for the world, the COVID-19 pandemic is far from over, but it's quite possible that the British government is losing the faith and authority over the British public to handle this serious situation.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio programme. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are still looking at the rights of women in Islam, and I don't need to repeat myself of why we're doing it, only because we're under attack, being labeled as a backward religion when it comes to giving women her rights, where in fact there is no system in the world that has given women more rights than Islam. The third right that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given to women is the right to learn. Yes, you heard me right. The right to learn. So you're saying, well, is there places where a woman doesn't have the right to learn? Yes. Back in the day, women weren't even supposed to read or write. And even today, if you look, do a bit of search on Google, you'll see a lot of places women are not even allowed to attend schools. And even in some civilized nations, women are not allowed to attend schools, or through some religious rituals or ideologies, you'll find that a lot of these ideologies do not allow women to learn for reasons I don't want to mention. What we see in Islam, it has given women her fundamental right to learn any kind of knowledge that will benefit her or humanity, whether it is matters of concerning things of living. For example, she can study psychology, maths, for example, or physics or chemistry or whatever subject she's into, she can learn it. And she could also learn Islamic studies. She could learn philosophy. She could learn Islamic principles or jurisprudence, or tafsir of the Quran, commentary of the Quran, and all these fields that a man could study, a woman could study. So she can study religious studies, and at the same time she could really study. At the same time she could study life studies, which we are required. So both are given to her. Where compared to other religions, they forbid women from learning religious stuff. They can learn other things, for example, but they cannot learn physical stuff. So Islam says no. In the same way that a man can learn, so can woman. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran, in chapter Ar-Rahman, in verse 3 and verse 4, he says, خَلَقَ الْإِنسَانِ, created humankind. And that insan, humankind, includes what? Both males and females. And then what does the ayah says? عَلَّمَهُ الْبَيَانِ, he taught him knowledge. He taught him how to speak. He taught him things, right? So that also includes what? Men and women. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in another verse, in verse 5 in chapter Al-Alaq, Allah says, عَلَّمَ الْإِنسَانَ مَا لَمْ يَعْلَمْ, he taught man or mankind, al-insan, mankind, what he did not know. And also again, Allah here says, when he says mankind, that includes both males and females. Again, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran, he says, in chapter Az-Zumar in verse 9, he says, قُلْ هَلْ يَسْتَوِي الَّذِينَ يَعْلَمُونَ وَالَّذِينَ لَا يَعْلَمُونَ, say, do those who know and those who do know are equal? Obviously not. Those who are logical, those who are knowledgeable, are much higher than those who are ignorant and not knowledgeable. So Allah, again in this ayah, includes both men and women. So women who are more knowledgeable, they're even higher than men who are not knowledgeable. And even higher than men who are knowledgeable if they are more knowledgeable than them. And so on and so forth. So Allah, in knowledge, when it comes to knowledge, he says both males and females have the right to learn and be learned. Let's take a break and we come back, inshallah.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You can send us your emails, comments and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are still listening to the program For Humanity. So before, we said Islam gives women the right to learn, and this is her fundamental right to learn any knowledge that a man could learn, or a knowledge that is allowed, obviously not a forbidden knowledge. So women can learn just like a man, compared to other societies, other cultures, other religions, other faiths, ideologies, and what have you. Even if we look at examples of from learned Islamic women, for example, we have a hadith that says the dowry of Hawa, the mother, or the Hawa, the wife of Adam alayhi salam, Eve as we call her, it's said in the narration that her dowry was for Adam to teach her. So knowledge was her dowry. So which means it's fundamentally a woman being given the right to learn. Khadija alayhi salam, the wife of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, which we mentioned in previous episode, she herself was a woman who were taught at the books of the previous religions like the Torah and the Injil, the Bible. She knew them. She was a smart woman. She was an educated woman. She was a woman, a businesswoman. So she was very educated before she even became a tradesperson and accumulated her wealth. So she knew both the knowledge of religions and she knew the knowledge of the material world. And she combined the two and gave us Khadija alayhi salam. Her daughter Fatimah al-Zahra salamullah alayha, where the Prophet says, Alimatun ghayr mu'allama. She's a learned person without being taught. And she, you know, she was herself Fatimah al-Zahra. And I don't want to say who Fatimah al-Zahra is, salamullah alayha, but her knowledge, she's infallible. Her knowledge precedes the knowledge of everybody beside her, obviously her father and her husband. So she's very knowledgeable herself, and that's just an example. Her daughter, so Khadija, her daughter is Fatima alayhi salam. The daughter of Fatima alayhi salam is Zainab, and we all know how eloquent and how smart and how knowledgeable Zainab alayhi salam. And we know this obviously through the sermons that she gave when she was being paraded through the streets of Kufa and in the castle of Yazid, may Allah curse him. And we see her eloquent and her knowledge flows through her tongue. And even when she was in Medina and when she was in Kufa, she was having her own classes. She used to teach women hadith and she used to teach women Quran. So she not only she was learning, but she was teaching. Also, now it's even a necessity to have women learning, for example, medicine, because we have women and our women need to be cured. So we need to have female doctors, female nurses. We need to have female teachers. We need to have female engineers. And we need that woman force in our life, right? Because sometimes our life depends on that aspect of learning. So it becomes compulsory on women to even learn. So Islam says woman has that right to learn, contrary to that of those who say women should not learn, because if they learn, then they will be corrupted. If they learn, they might lead. If they learn, they might create havoc on earth. No, not such a thing. Islam says any man, be it a male or female, if they have knowledge and taqwa and piety, they will be good. If a person, male or female, they have knowledge but they have no piety, then obviously their knowledge could lead them to being corrupted or corruption. So we need to be aware that Islam has given women the right to learn. Inshallah, we will continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صل يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
Our voice.
comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.